I'm Chris Lamb, and at the end of the session, or as we're talking, we can do two things at once: write down questions, and then I hope we'll have 15 or 20 minutes at the end of the session to answer your question. It's a real pleasure to be here and be a part of the panel with David and Pam and Larry. Talk about Wendell Smith, his life and legacy. Wendell Smith is so associated with Pittsburgh, but he was born in Detroit. His father was the head chef for Henry Ford. Smith grew up and went to school and played baseball without facing, as he would say later, any prejudice. In 1933, during the summer after his senior year of high school, he graduated. He played for American Legion team. In an internment game, he won it 1-0. And after the game, scouts came onto the field and talked to players, the opposing pitcher, and his teammate Mike Tresh, who later played 10 years in the American League, and signed contracts. And Wendell Smith is standing on the pitcher mound going, "Hey, guys, I'm here. What about me?" And one of the scouts said, "I'd like to sign you, kid. No blacks in baseball." And Wendell Smith went home that night and wept. He said, "That broke me up. That broke me up. It was then I made a vow that I would do whatever I could for Negro ball players. And that's why I became a sports writer." He went to work after he graduated from college. He went to work for the Pittsburgh Courier, where he made $17 a week, which coincidentally is the same salary I made when I went to work for newspapers in 1980. After 15 years, my salary doubled. But the Courier was the right newspaper for Smith, because the Pittsburgh Courier was the most important of black newspapers. It was always crusading for causes. It was always involved in civil rights. And over the next year, Smith and the Courier would engage in a campaign to confront segregation in America. But America, segregation in America was too big to get your hands around. But segregation in baseball wasn't. I'd like to introduce David Wiggins, who will carry on our talk about Wendell Smith.
Good afternoon. As I think all of you know in this room, one of the things that took place in the mid-20th century, is that we have a number of very, very important sports writers from black weeklies. Sports writers from black weeklies that spoke out consistently and adamantly about the segregation in Major League Baseball. We had sports writers for, the Cleveland Call, the Indianapolis Recorder, New York Amsterdam News, New York Age, Chicago Defender, you name it. We had sports writers, again, who were speaking out consistently and adamantly about the segregationist practices in Major League Baseball. And certainly one of those newspapers that was involved in speaking out about the segregationist practices in Major League Baseball was the Pittsburgh Courier. The Pittsburgh Courier started a campaign to try to include, to see if they could convince Major League Baseball to sign African-American players. And I think it began most seriously in 1933. We had sports writers like Chester Washington and Rollo Wilson and Alvin Moses and people like that who began to express their concerns or dissatisfaction with what was taking place in our national pastime. I would contend, however, that the campaign effort for the Pittsburgh Courier Journal really got its start in some ways, or most seriously, with the hiring of Wendell Smith in 1937 when he comes out of West Virginia State College. That was a very, very important hire for the newspaper more generally, but certainly it was an important hire as far as baseball was concerned. Wendell Smith was an extraordinary person, very smart, very disciplined, in many ways quite aggressive. He was a civil rights activist is the way I would assess Wendell Smith. And he was also an extraordinarily gifted and talented writer who began speaking out very seriously in 1938. What Wendell Smith does, at least the way I've written it in some of my writings, is he really does prick the consciousness, or at least attempts to prick the consciousness of the leaders of Major League Baseball and Americans more generally. And certainly with the advent of World War II and the Pittsburgh Courier's Double V campaign, Wendell Smith also points out the hypocrisy that was so evident in Major League Baseball. How could you deny black players participation at the highest level of the sport when we were fighting for the four freedoms? It was just too stark and too evident to Wendell Smith. Now, Wendell Smith and his campaign efforts, he does a number of different things. One of the things he does is he interviews players, white players, coaches, managers, the leadership in Major League Baseball. He makes various suggestions to the leaders in Major League Baseball as to what black players have the ability and the skills to play at that level of participation. I can't go through each and everything that Wendell Smith does, but let me just point out a couple of, I think, key instances in his career, or at least key instances in his campaign efforts to integrate Major League Baseball. One of those is his first column on the baseball issue that he publishes in 1938. What's interesting to me is he spends the majority of his column pointing out and trying to convince, or actually in some ways criticizes the African-American community for patronizing white ballparks and Major League Baseball and not paying enough attention to Negro League Baseball. I think that's one of his important columns. In 1939, another important event in Wendell Smith's career and specifically his efforts to integrate baseball is he was able to secure an interview with Ford Frick, the president of the National League. Important event in his campaign efforts. Unfortunately, not surprisingly, Ford Frick gave the usual kinds of dribble that sometimes would come out of the mouths of the leaders in Major League Baseball. Ford Frick told Wendell Smith that, well, Americans weren't ready to have African-American players in the sport. How would you handle spring training? How would you handle separate accommodations, restaurants, restrooms, et cetera, et cetera? So Smith came away from that conversation with Ford Frick being a bit disappointed. But it encourages him to follow up with a series of interviews that he conducted that were published in the Pittsburgh Courier Journal between July and September of 1939. What Wendell Smith does is he interviews 40 players and I believe 8 managers to assess their opinion about the segregation in the sport. A remarkable, it seems to me, that he would gain access to these players and these managers. Disappointed again, but it's quite interesting because out of those series of interviews, Wendell Smith finds out, at least from the players' perspective and from many of the managers' perspective, they were perfectly okay in allowing black players, at least that's what they expressed publicly. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but they expressed to him their willingness to play against and with black players. He's the man, of course, that suggests to Branch Rickey shortly after, I think actually during the meeting, in 1945, I'm sure as all of you know, Branch Rickey announces the creation of his United States Baseball League. And rumor has it that Branch Rickey pulls Wendell Smith aside and asks Wendell Smith who he thought would be the best player to what black player would be the best black player to integrate Major League Baseball. And Wendell Smith says Jackie Robinson. Ricky evidently took his advice and ultimately would sign Jackie Robinson to a contract. Now, let me just end up, and I think I'm probably almost out of time, Chris. We talk a lot about Ricky and Robinson and how important they were to each other, and I think they were important to each other. Robinson was important to Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey was extraordinarily important to Jackie Robinson. Without both of their efforts, who knows if the great experiment would have been successful, at least as early as it was. But I would contend that we should talk more seriously and more often about Smith and Robinson. Wendell Smith was extraordinarily important to Robinson, and Robinson was extraordinarily important to Smith. There was a symbiotic relationship there that I don't think we can't forget or should forget, and we should continue to talk about it. Wendell Smith became Jackie Robinson's friend. In many ways, at least in my view, Wendell Smith becomes Jackie Robinson's mentor. In many ways, Smith becomes Jackie Robinson's confidant. Smith kept track of Robinson's life in great detail. He's important, certainly, as I think many of you in this room know, and certainly important in regards to Jackie's first spring training. So there's this relationship I think is extraordinarily important that should be preserved. I would also say, and would end by noting, I think Wendell Smith is important to Jackie Robinson because he really does fashion a narrative about Robinson that I think is crucial to note. He fashions a narrative about this African-American who is able to overcome the odds and not just find his way into Major League Baseball, but to find or to realize a highly successful 10-year Hall of Fame career. He uses his pen, does Wendell Smith, and he creates this narrative about Jackie Robinson that I think is extraordinarily important for all of us to remember, at least those of us who have a particular interest in civil rights and have a particular interest in the integration process of Major League Baseball. That's enough.
Thanks, Dave.
So I'm going to talk a little bit about just from the context of the Pittsburgh Courier and its significance in the long civil rights movement. The Courier was founded in 1907 by a gentleman by the name of Edwin Nathaniel Harlson. He was a nighttime security guard at the local Heinz factory, and he purposely selected working at night because his passion was literary writing. And so he wrote a collection of poems called A Toiler's Life that was privately published in 1907. And he started using his own money and used that same title to entitle his first broadsheet publication. And eventually, by 1910, it evolved into the Pittsburgh Courier. So probably the biggest name associated with the Courier is that of Robert L. Vann. He was an up-and-coming attorney here in town. He had attended what would become University of Pittsburgh Law School. While he was there, he was an editor of the campus newspaper, so he was used to writing for news format. And he was enlisted by Harlson and some of his associates to assist in incorporating the newspaper. And quickly, Vann became a contributor as well. But by fall of 1910, there was a bit of a falling out. Harlson actually left the newspaper because he felt that he wanted it to maintain its literary heritage. And the other members of the board, who were all African Americans, felt that it was time for the city of Pittsburgh to have a proper black press. Media historian Patrick Washburn has famously quipped that prior to the black press rising up in our country, The only way that African Americans appeared in the news was if they were entertainers, if they were athletes, or if they were criminals. And I would say that it can be argued that these stereotypes still persist in our mainstream media sometimes today. Newspapers such as The Courier and its famous 20th century competitor, the Chicago Defender, really presented a counterpoint to that imagery. These newspapers were part of this rich tradition that began with Freedom's Journal in 1827. And the thing that was different about these newspapers was that basically they reported on all the same things that the mainstream newspapers reported on, except it was looking specifically at the African American community. So that meant births, high school graduations, weddings, businesses, civic involvement, all those different things that never appeared in the mainstream press. And part of it, though, was this idea that they were advocating not only for a different image of African Americans in American society, but also, in advocating for themselves in terms of, you know, bringing equality and social justice to our country. It should be noted that from the very beginning, among the first full-time employees, their very first newsroom had four full-time employees. One of them was a sports writer. And so sports topics ended up becoming a priority from very early on. The Courier's advocacy for African Americans obviously spread well beyond the sports pages, but it was really infused in every story and every topic. So here we have a couple different examples from the early 1930s. You have on April 5th, 1930, an article on the features page looking at William Grant Stills, an African-American composer who was a contemporary of Gershwin. They heavily influenced each other's music. Same month in 31, the Courier is urging readers to consider the $2.9 million African-Americans spend each month on white-owned businesses, many of which were blocking them from, you know, actually using them properly, but having to, you know, go back door or in hidden places because of segregation. And this was long before the bus and business boycotts of the formal civil rights movement that we think of, you know, with MLK and in the late 50s, starting with Rosa Parks, and then into the 1960s. And this kind of goes to the point that David was saying about, you know, questioning, you know, why African Americans were going to white ballparks if they weren't allowed to participate. The newspaper was really a strong advocate in this idea that they wanted to really consider their financial power and their political power to forge change. Probably the most significant was later that year, April 17th, 1932. After 2 decades of reporting on injustices, Robert Vann pretty much just dropped the gauntlet and during the presidential election of 1932 and said, you know, it's time for African Americans to, as a political bloc, to turn Lincoln's portrait to the wall, to abandon the GOP because they have promised them lots of things, but they have not delivered. They failed to provide, you know, equality after World War I despite their service. They failed to bring equality to African Americans during after the 19th Amendment, and you know, even during the Great Depression, you know, they were hit hardest. And so he basically said, "We are a strong political bloc. Let's forge some change." And it was quite successful. If it hadn't been for the African American voting bloc, you know, who knows whether FDR would have won or not. You know, it was a critical moment because it marked this major shift, not just from conservative black presses, which still remained faithful to the GOP, but it also recognized the political power of the African-American vote. And it marked an era for the Courier. It was a new time. It was a time when it went from being the underdog in the black press to, you know, actually the leader in the black press. Throughout the 1930s, the Courier became the largest circulation African-American newspaper in the country. They had 2 dozen city editions across the country, and they estimated their circulation in the millions. Part of that was because it was estimated that each copy of the newspaper actually passed hands multiple times. Because, you know, the wealthier family members would actually pass their paper on to friends and family. So sometimes it would exchange hands up to 12 times, which helped drive their circulation. Later that same decade, here's a couple of newspaper front pages and sports page sections of of Wendell Smith's series on baseball integration and interviewing. I think one of those is the sports page. It's an interview with the Phillies manager who was saying yes, he would permit Negro ball players on his team. And then you've got the New York Giants, Bill Terry, saying they will never crash the majors. And ushering into World War II, the Courier again maintained its significance in the community and reporting on civil rights movement. In 1942 alone, some of the topics that they addressed included everything from the American Red Cross, which initially banned the donation of African American blood. After Pearl Harbor, everyone was flooding donation centers wanting to give blood because that was an easy way to help the war effort. And at first they were banned from it, then they were segregating the blood. And the Courier covered that story repeatedly and consistently throughout 42 and 43. They also reported on the military and the racial issues that were popping up in different places across the country and looking at that. And then one of the biggest stories that they kind of championed in early on in the war was actually one of the heroes of Pearl Harbor. There was a messman that had been reported, leaving the mess hall, and he was on the West Virginia, and after it had been bombed, he raced up to the top of the deck, manned an anti-aircraft gun, allegedly took down at least one or two Japanese planes, and then went and helped rescue injured sailors. And there was this, a bunch of other sailors, white sailors, that were honored, given high awards. And it took a long time to find out, first of all, who this messman was, and then the Courier kind of took up the challenge of trying to advocate for him to actually receive military honors and recognition for his heroics. Eventually, he did receive the Congressional Medal of Honor, and he also received, the Navy, one of the awards from the Navy, the Navy Cross, which was like the third highest. But it's interesting because if you go back and look at the news coverage, a lot of the white sailors and military officials that were helping out with the efforts on that day would receive congressional medals like this. They would receive the Medal of Honor, which was the highest honor that the military gave. And Dory Miller was pretty much ignored. And then a year later, they wrote about him after his death. He was on a ship that was bombed by a Japanese submarine in the Battle of Mankin. And also going into World War II was this Double V, or Double Victory campaign. The Double V campaign was huge. It started off as a letter to the editor. There was a young man from Wichita, Kansas, who wrote a letter to the editor in the days after Pearl Harbor and said, "Why should I serve my country when, it's not even treating me fairly?" And so he ended his letter by basically saying, "Could there not be a double victory, one overseas and one at home?" And the Courier and Robert Vann, who was always one to promote his paper, said, this is a catchy phrase. And so within, I think the initial letter to the editor ran the last week, January 31st of 42. By February 14th, just 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, they had launched the Double Victory campaign. They had logos for it. And on the far right, the February 21st, 42, you see the Double V logo real big on the upper right corner, and then you see a woman flashing the Double V symbols. And this campaign was really remarkable because it infused all across America. There were clubs that would pop up. It influenced hairstyles and clothing. A lot of African American women's clothing would have a V pattern in it. Their hair would be done in a Double V part, and it took over. And what's interesting about it is that it was actually a really unifying element, because despite a lot of political differences between other black presses, even the Chicago Defender picked up the Courier's Double V and promoted it. And so you would see news coverage in African American papers all over the country talking about Double V campaign and the Double V clubs that popped up because of it. It's you need to note here too that in 42, while the Courier is promoting, you know, support for the victory overseas and at home, and supporting and writing about African American troops preparing to go into battle, which at that point the military did not allow them to do, they were questioned and followed regularly by our government because they felt that some of the columnists that were writing were questioning, why should we even fight? Isn't this a white man's war? And so because of that, there was concerns of violating the sedition law of 1918, and so a lot of the newspapers, editors, and the newspaper itself was followed and kind of bugged. In addition to that, it wasn't just our government that was following them and watching every move, but also the British government. Because of columnists like George Padmore and George Schuyler, you know, they would constantly question Great Britain's colonial policies in places like India, the West Indies, Africa, and South America. And because of those kinds of columns, the Colonial Office actually had people that were following them and reporting back to the government about the actions and activities of the Courier staff. And then following World War II, you know, obviously the Courier continued to write a lot about press race relations and really kind of shifting away from war and conflict and looking more within American society. One of the easy and obvious things for them to write about were housing conditions. There's an article here in 47 looking at the deplorable conditions in the 11th District in St. Louis, Missouri. As well as African-American GIs that were struggling to take advantage of some of the benefits of the GI Bill. And in this October 25th, 47, we see some of these photos up at the top demonstrating some of these conditions. And at that same newspaper, that same day, you have a little bit down page, the commander of the American forces in Germany basically saying that we would not integrate the military forces in Germany because even though there was concern about the Russians using this as propaganda against capitalism and against the West, he felt pretty strongly about it. It should be noted that a year later, Truman actually did desegregate the military, and that was the first American institution to be desegregated. But I would also note just that, you know, other things that are pretty impressive about the newspaper was just that it was a place that not just the men of that worked there, but also women were given a lot of high-profile positions. When Robert Vann died, he made his wife promise him that she would continue the paper's legacy, which she did. In addition to that, in 1929, they had a woman by the name of Julia B. Jones who became the first city editor of the newspaper. 20 years later, Hazel Garland would hold that position for a number of years and kind of lead the newspaper into the formal civil rights movement. And, you know, Jessie Vann, she had a lot of opportunities to sell the newspaper, but resisted them a lot of times because she was concerned that white publishers interested in buying the newspaper would compromise the newspaper's mission. And eventually they did sell to the Chicago Defender in 1964, which a lot of people in the Pittsburgh community felt betrayed by. They felt that, you know, the Courier was selling out to their biggest competitor. It still publishes today under the masthead of the new Pittsburgh Courier. But unfortunately, like a lot of black presses across the country, after the formal civil rights movement, a lot of the newspapers kind of lost their focus. A lot of their top talent was pilfered by the mainstream press, which suddenly realized that it needed to do a better job of covering the black community. And so even though it's still publishing, its voice was definitely diminished.
Larry, thank you.
Thank you, Pamela. good afternoon. I'm going to start by going to the end and read a quote from the Chicago Defender from his obituary. They wrote, "Smitty had a vision of American society where ability, skill, and character are the sole measures of a man and not the color of his skin. I found that to be very Martin Luther King-ish. He pursued that idealism not with the militancy of the new breed of black spokesmen, rather than with calm and patience of logic, a wise man whose vision was sharp enough to see the light at the end of the tunnel. He has made his contribution. History will not pass him by. And that's why we are here today, to honor the great Wendell Smith. In 2014, the National Association of Journalism awarded Wendell Smith the Red Smith Award. And I was asked to accept the award on behalf of his widow, Wilnella, at the Crystal City Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. It just happened to be his 100th birthday on June the 27th, 2014. Wendell Smith is on my Mount Rushmore of writers, along with Sam Lacy, Shirley Povich, and the great Rodney King, Lester Rodney. Yeah, big difference. Lester Rodney from the New York Daily Worker. So I was honored to give that speech on behalf of Wilnella Smith. And fortunately, in order to do so, I visited with her in Chicago at her high-rise assisted living place right off of Lakeshore Drive. What an experience. She lives in the same assisted living place as Mary Frances, the widow of Bill Veeck, and they're good friends. So it was interesting to sit there and talk to this lady. She's in her 90s, not a wrinkle on her face. She told me her secret, and I'm gonna keep it a secret. But she's doing well. I think she turns 94 in about 3 weeks, July the 14th. Fabulous lady, very professional. So I asked her about some of the personal attributes of this writer. And she told me that he was very low-key, he was humbled, and he never brought his work home. He said he could be very serious about his work and his mission to integrate baseball, but he never took himself serious. In his spare time, he played golf, basketball, and he was an avid reader from his massive library. His favorite subject was the Civil War, and that's how he knew about military tactics to fight Major League Baseball's segregation plan. He loved the Civil War history. So I asked him, what was he really like? He said he was a busybody. Always active. You could find him looking at today, if he was alive today, he'd be looking at the History Channel or C-SPAN, working on a New York Times crossword puzzle, and playing chess on the internet all at the same time. He was an early day Jeopardy champion. The man was just brilliant. So what about the man, the husband? Said he was very loving. He had a wonderful sense of humor that she shared with me. He kept me laughing all the time. That's her words. And he liked to play jokes on his colleagues and other writers in the press room. And he said when he went on long trips, he showed his romantic side. He would leave love notes all over the house. He would have stickums on the refrigerator door, on the toilet seat, under the pillow. In the bedroom, he would leave notes by the plants that need watering. Everywhere she would go throughout the home, there would be little love notes from Wendell Smith. This is the Wendell Smith that I came to know and love. And she speaks highly of him. And I've learned a little bit from her on how I can get through the next 41 years of my marriage. So I'll leave it there, but I want you to know that Wendell Smith is a great role model for all of us. and welcome any of your questions, comments, or concerns.
Yeah. Yes, sir. I can a little bit, I think. He had actually had probably several, you know careers. He was the first black, you know, to get his press credentials. That the color line was lasted longer for sports writers than it did for baseball players. And as David said, Wendell Smith had to do his interviews. He could not go into the locker rooms, the dugouts, or on the field. He had to wait, I believe, in the Schenley Hotel, where the opposing team stayed when they came to, and he would hang out in the lobbies. And then he went, something here, he went to work. He was the first black sports writer working for a white newspaper, where he worked for the Chicago Herald American. And then he went to work for WGN. He spent his last, few years, and my brother was at Northwestern University at that time and remembered seeing him. And that also opened up an area for blacks as well. Anybody else? Please, if you have questions, write them on the index card. Here's a, what did you think of Andre Holland's portrayal of Smith in 42?
I thought he did a wonderful job. Yeah. 42, as we all know, had a lot of missteps. I mean, as you saw, according to the movie 42, Branch Rickey introduced Robinson to Smith, as we know, Wendell Smith introduced Jackie Robinson to Wendell Smith. And then we saw Wendell Smith on the third base line writing texts, because at that time, Wendell Smith, an African American, was not able to sit in the press box with his colleagues. So to keep that persona and keep that calmness, I think the actor did a very good job reflecting on the true Wendell Smith that we know today.
That Branch Rickey paid Wendell Smith during that his first spring training, to be his bodyguard, his chauffeur, his father confessor, and another black photographer, sports writer, accompanied Wendell Smith. His name is Billy Rowe. He was not in the movie, but how I got interested in race and Jackie Robinson and sports is when I was a columnist in Daytona Beach in March 1993. I talked to Billy Rowe. And he told me about what that spring was like, and he talked about, you probably all know about Jackie Robinson's ride, his 48-hour trip from Los Angeles to Daytona Beach, getting kicked off two planes, riding a Greyhound bus, and the bus driver calling him boy and sending him to the back of the bus. And this is his trip, this is before he's even played any spring training, and by the time he got to Daytona Beach, he was 190 pounds of just pure angry. And Wendell Smith, and when Rachel went off the bed, Wendell Smith and Billy Rowe stayed up all night with him, because Jackie Robinson was saying, I can't do this. This is just the beginning. I want to go back. I want to go back to the Negro Leagues. And Wendell Smith and Billy Rowe telling him, you don't have a choice. Do you have anything, on this as well? Here we have a question here. What prompted Smith to leave the Courier and move to Chicago? I don't know. Imagine it's money, I would think. The idea of, that's one of the tragedies, is just like the Negro Leagues, is that blacks played in the shadow and they made little money. Finally, he had a chance to improve his a profile. Did Smith and Jackie stay in touch after Smith left the Courier and covering the Dodgers? That's a great question. They stayed in touch, but they had a falling out. He became, Jackie, you want to take
no,
the
go
stand?
Ahead. No, go
ahead. Is what happened is that Smith became Robinson's ghostwriter for Pittsburgh Courier. He was Robinson's intermediary. Because white sports writers would not interview Robinson, so they'd go to Smith. In 1948, Wendell Smith ghost wrote Robinson's autobiography, and he made mistakes in the autobiography. And this caused a rift between the player and the sports writer. For instance, in Robinson's own autobiography, he has his name wrong. He calls him John Roosevelt Robinson, and his name was Jack Robinson, Roosevelt Robinson, and he referred to his mother as Molly, and his mother's name was Mally, and that caused a rift. And Jackie Robinson criticized the Negro Leagues, and as David's written, the black sports writers, you know, when that happened, because they sort of shot back at Robinson. And then Smith also criticized Robinson for, among other things, endorsing Republican candidates. And who could blame him? anything you can to that, David?
Well, I think one of the things that strikes me about Wendell Smith is what was similar to the owners in Negro League Baseball and many other people, and that is the struggle it must have been, because, you know, the sense that I get from reading Smith's columns is this is somebody that obviously believed in individual success, but he had to also deal, as an African-American during the era of segregation, he had to deal with this notion of group loyalty, but also having to deal with this with integrationist ambitions. You know, and I think it's fascinating the conflicts in some ways that people had. You know, I certainly think of Negro League owners having to deal with this sort of thing. You know, they were businessmen and women in one case particularly. What a struggle that must have been. You know, you want to stay in business, but you also want to see blacks have an opportunity to play at the highest levels of the sport. You know, and it's interesting to me to read. You can kind of get a sense of those conflicts in their writings. I'd encourage all of you, by the way. Larry was mentioning, did you say Mount Rushmore, Larry, of your
yes.
of writers?
Mm-hmm.
I would encourage everyone to go in and take a look at some of the writings of black sports writers. Not just Wendell Smith,
right.
But Sam Lacy, Chester Washington, Rollo Wilson.
Faye Young
is another one I think of immediately. Mm-hmm. You know, segregation, you know, they were mired in segregation as well. Here they are fighting on behalf of black players in Intermajor League Baseball, but they were suffering the same thing. These are people that were not able to find their way into many of they were not able to find their way into white dailies. They were in essence functioning behind what I always call the walls of segregation. But they were extraordinarily talented, and in today's world, they would be with the New York Times and the Washington Post and the other great newspapers across the country.
I'd like to add to that too. Just, you know, it's interesting that you make the point of, you know, the influence of breaking the segregation, the color barrier in baseball, and how that, you know, basically marked the death knell of the Negro Leagues. And for a lot of black presses, the same phenomenon happened. You know, as major news outlets started realizing that they needed to tell this side of a story that they had not told at all. They started hiring the best and brightest from the Courier, from the Defender, from the Amsterdam News, from the Guide and Light and the Baltimore, papers, and so it, the Afro-American, and, it kind of did the same thing to the black press in that it really took the best and brightest and left them with, struggling for purpose and struggling for talent.
And Pam, when your research, when you were looking at the Courier, was there a lot of sports coverage in the Courier?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so no, I think that
very
it's,
much so.
And it wasn't just on the sports pages. You know, they were really quick to pull, anything that they thought was going to highlight, either accomplishments or, challenges or controversies, they would quickly pull that off the sports page and put it on the front page.
You know, I'd like to add, in 1939, when he was doing the interview with the managers and the players, that took up a full sports page and sometimes two pages, along with the box scores. So a large percentage of the newspaper was devoted to Wendell Smith's writings during that period.
And there were stories that would come out in this series that people didn't know about. Leo Durocher came out emphatically and said there should be blacks in baseball, and told the story about when he was in Hartford, Connecticut, and he was working as a factory job. And we now think of Leo Durocher as having complete self-confidence. But he was called to be, he was signed to play in one of the Yankees' farm system, and he didn't want to go. And he had a black, a fellow worker in this factory, and Durocher tells him, I don't think I'm good enough. And David Redd, the fellow he worked with, said, well, if you don't do this, I'm never going to speak to you, because I wish I had had your chance, and a lot of my friends wish they had had their chance, and for you to have the chance and not to go through on it. And Durocher tells this story about David Redd, and I'm pretty sure that story would not have appeared in the white press.
Right.
Here's a story. Did Wendell Smith have an association affiliation with white sports writers?
Well, not really.
Well, yeah, he probably, he was,
you know,
was not, they were afraid, white sports writers were afraid of interviewing Jackie Robinson, so they would interview Wendell Smith. But Wendell Smith grew up, I was talking about Sam Lacy grew up with Bob Constantine, and they became close friends. But Wendell Smith, I'm not sure it had the same kind of closeness, because they couldn't hang out together.
I really don't know.
Let me add to that. When he did the interviews and the Double V campaign, you had people like Dan Egan from the Boston newspaper and Shirley Povich from Washington Post. You had the Sporting News. They all piggybacked on what Wendell was writing and saying that he is right. We should integrate baseball. And we look at the timeline here when he did the interviews from July of 39 to September of 39. That's the same month that Adolf Hitler invaded Poland and started World War II. Mm-hmm. So you see he's on the brink of raising everybody's consciousness about racism abroad and racism at home. And so this interviews lead into the Double V campaign, which is very powerful. I mean, people all over the country running around like this, giving the V sign, front page. You know, sports moves from that section to the front page for the first time ever. We cannot have sports without politics. As we see, that's why we have the president throughout the first pitch. Military, we have camouflage uniforms. So people want to separate that, but it's not possible. That's why we sing the American Legion. I mean, pledge to the Legion, national anthem. So Wendell Smith was a game changer. You know, he started a movement before there was a civil rights movement. And we should give him credit for that.
Well, he tried to get the Red Sox.
Yeah.
In 1945, he accompanied Jackie Robinson and Marvin Williams and someone else to Fenway Park.
Sam Jethro,
thank you. Well, here's a question that plays off yours, Larry, and a little bit of politics. Would Wendell Smith be talking about the kneeling issue today in the NFL about police brutality?
Most definitely.
Yeah.
Most definitely.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that looks like an opportunity to vent.
Right.
He would be all over it.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Any other questions?
I think Wendell Smith was a genius about pointing out the hypocrisy of it all and pricking the consciousness of people. It's interesting, though, even before Wendell Smith comes along, the black press was doing something similar. Because, you know, I've done a bit of research on the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin. It's really fascinating to see or to read the pieces in the black press about the proposed boycott or discussion of a boycott of the 1936 Olympic Games in Berlin.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, you have a lot of folks from the New York Amsterdam News and New York Age and et cetera who are talking about the hypocrisy of it all. Here you have well-known African-American athletes like Jesse Owens and Jackie's older brother, Mac,
mm-hmm.
Who we're going to send off to Berlin. Yet when they come back home, they're going to experience the same forms of racial segregation that they experienced when they left. But here we have an Olympic Games being held in a country that's spouting this notion of Aryan racial superiority.
Right.
So the irony of it all and how well and how it's really genius on the part of the black press to pick up on it and talk about it in that way. It really does bring it home, I think, the hypocrisy of it all.
One thing I want to add to that, too, it's interesting when you look at the Courier papers, especially during the Double Victory campaign, a lot of times they would actually on the top of the front page have photos of like the mayor of New York or, you know, different politicians reading the Courier or flashing the Double V campaign sign. And it was sort of like, in some ways, I feel like they were also, you know, writing to the woke white Americans, mm-hmm. you know, saying mm-hmm. you're not alone. You know, there's others that like you with, you know, in places of political capacity that, you know, could help change, but they need to know that they're not alone. So I think that it's interesting to see how that, you know, is throughout the paper during those years.
And readers could also see photographs of soldiers lining up in a V formation.
Yeah, yeah.
That was so powerful.
And before Wendell Smith, black sports writers tend to be accommodationists, like Ches Washington, who had been mm-hmm. sports editor. And Wendell Smith, when David referred to it, he could be bitterly cynical. He could be very critical. And that wasn't the way that black, you know, sports writers were writing until he came along and made that acceptable.
You know, I was also struck by the question about was Wendell friends with the white sports writers? I don't know if he was friends with the white sports writers, but he certainly made connections. And I was thinking specifically, Chris mentioned the tryout with the Boston Red Sox in 1945.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about the connection that Smith had evidently made with Ira Muchnick. And I think that needs to be remembered too, the connections that you had with African Americans and also Jewish Americans, you know, including mm-hmm. Shirley Povich and those kinds of people.
Well, and Dave Egan, they could, white society could ignore black newspapers because white America didn't even know that black newspapers existed. But when Wendell Smith would talk to Dave Egan, who was a sports writer, a Boston sports writer, and then Dave Egan would write about it in the Boston newspaper, then it got to the, you know, the white readers. And when Wendell Smith would work with Isidore Muchnick, who was a city councilman in Boston, it got to the, you know, the white readers.
Right, and then
come on, we got a few more questions here.
Also influenced Jimmy Powers of New York Daily News and Dan Parker.
Did you have cards, anybody? Or?
Dan Parker of the New York Daily Mirror.
Okay.
Is there an archive of the
Do you know? I know
well,
at
the,
the
Library
Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Hall of Fame has them. Newspapers.com, you could access the Pittsburgh Courier.
I also oftentimes use ProQuest. Is
yes.
something else that I always go to for historical newspapers.
Maybe a couple more questions, and then maybe these two. Possible. I mean, because Jackie Robinson had to unwind, and he usually did it with Rachel. He would come home, and he would just, because he's a pretty intense guy. And Wendell Smith had to, with that spring training was so awful in 46. If you want to know more, you can read Blackout. I think it's selling in the room there. But, yes.
Dr. Christopher Lamb.
It's highly possible. But, I mean, David, what do you think?
Well, could you repeat that question one more time?
Well, I was just mentioning that, you know, Jackie and Rachel were both highly intelligent, college-educated people who, you know, could navigate the world on their own terms to a degree, but without Wendell Smith, could he still have succeeded in the major leagues?
Well, that... Yeah, the latter part of my comments was, I think, I was kind of trying to address that, actually, that we always talk about Ricky and Robinson, but I think we should mm-hmm. think more seriously about talking more regularly about the connection between Smith and Robinson. I'm not so sure he could have.
Yeah.
He really needed, listen, we all need somebody. And Jackie had Wendell, and I just don't know if he could have made it without his support and without his, quite frankly, without his loyalty and without his smarts. I'll tell you, Wendell, you talk about navigation. Wendell Smith is somebody who knew how to navigate. I've always been so impressed with the way he could rule his world. I wish, by the way, that I would have had a chance like Larry did to talk to his mm-hmm. wife. I would have loved to have found out. This guy was extraordinary in my view.
David wrote one of the first pieces on Wendell Smith, maybe the first piece on Wendell Smith. One more question.
Are any of you familiar with Sheep Jackson of Boston? He wrote for a couple of papers in Boston, boys.
That's the Boston Globe.
It was. He was a black newspaper.
Oh, really?
So what would that have been? What newspaper
would
that
have been?
Might have. But they were asked if we knew about a black sports writer in Boston in the 1940s. Wasn't there a guy named like Murray Keltzel or something? Yeah. No, we'll have to go look him up now.
Yeah.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks, Mark and Jacob and Sabre, for this. Thank you, David.